So what I'm going to tell you about today is a very humble project, actually. But sometimes it's good to start with something that's very simple and understand it before you move on to more difficult things. So we're going to talk today a little bit about some work that I did with Eric Poppitz and a graduate student by the name of Sahi Yavin and Roman Konyuk on supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And so that's a pretty simple thing. And the thing that got me thinking about it was this plot from a paper from 2000 by Catterall and Gregory, where they're looking at the mass gap for the fermionic excitations and the bosonic excitations in this very simple supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And they ought to be degenerate. And here, the dashed curve is the boson as a function of lattice spacing. And you can see it's going down here. And the fermion state is going up to the continuum value. And it doesn't look good. So this is discretized time, yes. So it's just a Monte Carlo simulation. And it's at order one coupling. I know this says G is 100 here, but actually the dimensionless thing is G over M squared. So it's an order one coupling. So that looked kind of strange, and I didn't quite understand why that would be. What I'd always believed was that quantum mechanics was safe and shouldn't expect any problems. So I wanted to understand that. And it's a very simple system, so it should be able to understand this completely. And I think of it as kind of a basic test, and we learned some things just looking at this simple system. It's analytically tractable because you can, first of all, solve a one-dimensional Schrodinger equation to arbitrary precision. And it's a small system, so you know we can do it on a PC quite easily. And it turns out this has a positive semi-definite fermion matrix, so there's no real problems of principle here, or practical problems. And it does concisely illustrate some issues that arise in the more interesting higher dimensional systems where there's time and space that's discretized. And there's also a lattice action that preserves exactly half the supersymmetry. So we might learn something about other approaches, say that David Kaplan has introduced, or Simon Catterall for field theories, where there's some exact supersymmetry in the action. And how is this helpful? And why is it helpful? So here's the continuum imaginary time action. It's very simple. There's just a real coordinate x. And there's some one component Grassmann variables here, sidebar. And you integrate over both of them in the partition function. There's time that goes from 0 to L here. There's a function of the real variable x, the boson. It's first derivative squared is the scalar potential. And then there's a Yukawa interaction that happens here through the second derivative of H, which depends on x. H is referred to here as a superpotential. And so you can see that the interaction terms for the bosons are related to the interaction terms of the fermions. And this is where you get the supersymmetry. You can check that there's an infinitesimal symmetry transformation where epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 are independent Grassmann parameters. And if you stick these into this action, you will get that it is exactly invariant. To prove it, you only need two things, that you have the Leibniz rule, and that both the bosons and fermions are periodic in this from 0 to L. Now, if you want to study at finite temperature, you would break the supersymmetry. But if you keep periodic boundary conditions and take L to infinity, you would be studying the partition function that you'd like to study at zero temperature. So the problem, of course, is that the Leibniz rule is violated by the discretization, and depending on the goodness of your discretization, and there'll be some power p, and so you won't really have a supersymmetric lattice action when you start sticking in finite difference operators for the derivatives that appear here. Now, let's see, next two. You can define supercharges. These are the charges associated with the symmetry transformation by just saying wherever I saw a delta, let me replace it with my epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 and some supercharge q, and then you can verify that this is the action of those q's on the fields, and they have an anti-commuting algebra here that's related to the Hamiltonian for the system. To get this, you have to either introduce auxiliary fields or you have to impose equations of motion. But if the equations of motion hold, then this is the supersymmetry algebra that we're studying. In what follows, we will... Well, I should also back up one step. I mean, it's pretty clear how you would discretize this algebra. You just replace these with finite difference operators. The superpotential, we'll separate off the mass term here, and then there's a interaction term which could contain higher powers of the boson. And the particular case that we'll study will be the one with a quadratic term in the superpotential and a quartic term in the superpotential, and this defines M and G for you.
So if G is equal to 0, does everything work nicely, or is it
yes.
Already
nice? Yes. Yes, you can choose a discretization of the free action where the Leibniz rule does hold, actually, so for quadratic action. Let's see now. So the naive replacement, taking the time derivative and replacing it by a finite difference operator, that's what I will call the naive action. And if we take and replace by backward difference operator for the bosons, that's what we'll do for defining the naive action. And we'll replace, in the fermion term, we'll replace it by the Wilson finite difference operator, where there's a symmetric difference operator and then a Laplacian, and some adjustable parameter r here. For r equals 0, there will be doublers then. And this will help us to understand why the boson wasn't going to the continuum value. It actually, you can interpret it in terms of doublers, as you will see. And then, of course, in one dimension, you have this nice property that this operator at r equals plus or minus 1 goes to either the backward difference operator or the forward difference operator. So actually, we're taking into account kind of the naive discretizations here. Either r is plus 1 or minus 1. And the boson term, they're equivalent. So then, here's the lattice action that we will study. This here. And there's the superpotential terms that give the scalar potential for the bosons, and then there's the Yukawa interactions here. We'll define A to be the size of the system over N, where N is the number of sites, and it's periodic both for the fermions and the bosons, so we don't break supersymmetry with the boundary conditions. And we will introduce this this discretization of this supersymmetry algebra, but it's not crucial how you discretize it. What you want to see is that you recover the continuum supersymmetry algebra and the continuum supersymmetry Ward identities when you study these transformations in correlation functions. So for instance, if I take this action and I apply Q1 to it, what you see is it's not zero. And there's, so I factored out the overall A, which has to do with discretizing the integral over dt. And then there's still an A hiding here, here, and here. That's the order A suppression, so that in the classical limit, this just goes over to zero, these first three terms. And then this one here, the last one, you can check that this is actually a total derivative summed over sites, so it's zero up to order A of x. So actually everything here is order A. When you apply the supersymmetry transformation, you get something that's order A suppressed, because it's only the Leibniz rule that's getting you into trouble. Okay, so our understanding of what's going on here is based on power counting. And what you do is you just take this superpotential, you work out what the interaction terms are in the action. There's three. There's a quartic, and then there's one with a sixth power, the boson, and then there's one with the Yukawa interaction that has the fermions and a square of the bosons. None of those interaction vertices have an explicit lattice spacing appearing in them, so they don't contribute to the UV degree. And you can just write down what the constraints are. D here is the UV degree, and then you can work out what are the diagrams that have degree greater than or equal to zero. It turns out there's just one. This is true in the continuum as well. There's one that has degree equal to zero, and it's this diagram here with the fermion line right here, and that has degree zero. Now what happens in the continuum is that comes from this piece in the fermion propagator, but that under p goes to minus p changes sign, and so that contribution just vanishes in the continuum, and you're left only with the d equals minus one part. And then what happens is that this integral here is of order 1 over m, which cancels the m in the numerator, and you get a 6g times 1/2. So that's the continuum. In the lattice, though, with the naive lattice, what happens is that in addition to this piece that's odd under k goes to minus k and the usual m that's there, you also have this effect from the Wilson term. And this is even under k goes to minus k, so it doesn't vanish. And if you work out what the sum is here in the large n limit, you'll find that it's precisely equal to what comes from the m. So you get something that's twice as big as what it ought to be. And this is what the problem is that there's a extra contribution. You can understand it as coming from the doublers. It's not decoupling because it's d equals zero. So there's no decoupling theorem. And you have to introduce a counterterm. It's just that simple. So we introduce a counterterm here that will precisely cancel this extra 3g that comes in. And it doesn't change the power counting at all because it's just a mass correction. And now we're guaranteed that once we introduce this counterterm, since every other diagram is d less than zero, every other diagram is d less than zero, those diagrams all are guaranteed to go to their continuum limit just because of Rice's theorem. The d equals zero diagram, we fixed it goes to its continuum limit. So the entire perturbation series goes to the continuum perturbation series in the small a limit.
So that extra term is invariant over your exact lattice?
This is not the action of lattice. This is the naive action. Yeah.
So you don't have any?
I don't need any cancellations at all here. Okay, so that fixes it in perturbation theory. We have the right theory once this counterterm. So it's nice. It's a super normalizable theory. We only have to evaluate one diagram. We still would like to see, though, what happens non-perturbatively. You never know, there could be some, when you evaluate non-perturbatively, you could find that there's some corrections that wouldn't appear in perturbation theory that are different from what you expect in the, what you want to have in the continuum. So I'll next show that these terms are absent, that with the one counter term determined by perturbation theory, we get the right continuum limit, even up to non-perturbative effects. And we'll simultaneously be able to make an order A improvement, because what we're going to do is apply transfer matrix technology to this. So the way we set it up is that we introduce some local counterterms. Where we had the scalar potential for the bosons before, we just replace it by itself plus some correction, k. And where we had a Yukawa interaction, we add some extra function, l. And then what we're going to do is write down the transfer matrix that gives us the lattice action with these counterterms in them, and extract the Hamiltonian from the transfer matrix in the small a limit, and see what these two counterterms must be. That's the plan. So you can show that this, with those counterterms introduced into the lattice action, this transfer matrix gives the lattice action. And so there's operators Q and P that are just your normal position and momentum operators for the bosons. There's raising and lowering operators for the fermions. You wedge this in between, you know, states, and you can get back your lattice action. And you just do straightforward manipulations with the algebra of the Q's and P's and B's. And you can show that in the A goes to one limit, A goes to zero limit, that this transfer matrix becomes something of this form. There's an E to the AH minus AH, and then there's some conjugation factors here that are basically related to just a change in basis for the coherent or the resolution of identity that you stick in transfer matrix formalism.
So we can actually work out the eigenvectors of this transfer matrix without taking A small? I mean, presumably numerically, but I mean, without any Monte Carlo.
And with arbitrary, well, but what we want to do it for arbitrary H, okay, without saying what H is.
Well, you've got H being arbitrary, okay, not picking a particular H.
Right, we want to do all theories.
K and L.
And we want to figure out what K and L have to be.
So but after the fact.
After the fact, yes.
Particular H.
Yes.
I could presumably put in, and then go back and see does the real solution actually.
Yes.
Nicely approach.
Yes, yes. Okay, so here you work out what H is. It's this expression here up to some order A squared things. And these are the conjugation factors. It's not important, but that's what they are. And what you want to do is match this continuum Hamiltonian. This is the Hamiltonian of the continuum theory to this, and that determines the counterterms. So this is what they are. The shift in the scalar potential for the bosons is just the second derivative of the superpotential. And in the Yukawas, we can make an order A improvement by adding the square of that. And this matches what we had in perturbation theory over here. So, and this is non-perturbative. So we know now that we've reproduced the continuum Hamiltonian with our counterterm. And we also get an order A improvement to the naive action. So here's the order A improvement for the Yukawa interaction. Here's our counterterm. And we did it for any H, not the specific superpotential that I had before. We did it for all. So I like I said, this is a kind of a humble project, but as you can see, we can get quite far in it because it is such a simple system. So let's look at what happens with the word identity. We already know it's going to be fine once the counterterm is introduced, because we showed that the whole perturbation series of the continuum was recovered, but let's just see how this works out. You can write your supersymmetry variation of any operator O is equal to the variation of the action times O, because the measure is invariant. And then you can extract out this A, that we remember that Q times S, or Q of S, always has an order A suppression. So let me just pull out that A. There's some operator Y here, and I want its expectation value with the operator O. Now the point is that when I act with Q on S, I can get things of higher UV degree than are actually appearing in S. So even if this action, you know, only gives a perturbation series that has D equals zero diagrams, this operator here can have things of higher UV degree in it, which can overcome the A. And so that's what happens if you don't introduce the counterterm. If you look at what Q of one of S is, it's got something that's got right here, this is a UV degree 3 thing that'll appear in the diagrams. Here's UV degree 2. So these actually are sufficient to give you inverse powers of A. And then you can check that when you stick those in, you get something non-zero, and the, say, one-loop diagrams of some simple operators. And you can check that when you put in the counterterm, those contributions vanish. Like I said, that was not unexpected, because we had the perturbation series, right? Now, here's a different lattice action. This is one that has an exact supersymmetry. And so you can see here that the boson part is this, well, it's here, it's squared. So it includes a cross term now that you wouldn't have naively written. And then you've got something that looks very similar here for the fermion matrix. And that's, of course, just the derivative of what's here. You can rewrite this in terms of a Nicolai map. And here is what appears under the square. And then the fermion matrix is the derivative of that. So this makes the partition function kind of trivial once you integrate out the fermions. You can also see that this exact supersymmetry is really very simple here once you write it in the Nicolai variables. You just vary this psi bar by n, so you get an n dn. And then over here, you vary this, and you get an n dn from this variation, and the two things cancel. And then you can get to this also using a superfield approach. What happens here is you get new interactions, and they come from the cross term here, and they come from the fact that I have to have the same difference operator here as I have here, so there's kind of a Wilson interaction term. It's what I mean is that there's something that involves the Laplacian here in interactions for the bosons and R. So there's these two new vertices, and they change the power counting. You can count it like this. You can say, let me group all the things that have four bosons in it. This vertex now has degree 1. And you stick it into your algebra, you grind the crank, and what you find is that there's a second diagram that contributes now. So whereas in the naive lattice action, this gave had D equals 0, this is also D equals 0. So the scalar loop now is more divergent than it was before. And in fact, what you find, you go through this, is that these are the two expressions. I have the scalar loop here, same denominator because of the exact lattice supersymmetry. Here's the fermion. And what happens is then that this Wilson term is precisely canceled against this. So the d equals 0 parts of the diagrams cancel against each other, and you're left only with a d equals minus 1 part coming from the masses here. And you recover the continuum result. So in this case, the one exact supersymmetry allows you to avoid introducing any counter terms. The only d equals 0 diagrams cancel, and the rest of it's all d less than 0. And so you're guaranteed to get the right perturbation series. And we also did a transfer matrix analysis on this action and found that non-perturbatively things worked out, meaning that we recovered the continuum Hamiltonian. So what is the interpretation of this? This should say d greater than or equal to 2. For d greater than or equal to 2 theories, or field theories that we might want to study, we expect that some exact lattice supersymmetry will similarly improve UV behavior, the perturbation series. So we expect that if you can enforce some lattice supersymmetry, things will cancel that wouldn't naively cancel. And this will help you. You might have no counterterms required, or you might have less counterterms to adjust. And that could be helpful, depending on the situation. What happens non-perturbatively, whether those perturbative counterterms are sufficient, is less clear, and I think you kind of have to take it a case-by-case basis. For example, for a simple West amino type model, this is just a scalar field, complex scalar field coupled to some two-dimensional Majorana fermions. And in this case, where there's four supercharges, we showed that in the one exact lattice supersymmetry does lead to the continuum perturbation series. There's the cancellations you need to get rid of d equals 0 diagrams. And so it's kind of non-trivial here that you get the right continuum perturbation series, because you only preserve one supersymmetry out of four, so you have to recover three. And you have to recover an SO2 rotation invariance because it's broken by the lattice action in this case. And there's a chiral U1 for the massless theory that you also have to recover. And these all have to be recovered as accidental symmetries. It's some kind of long distance thing. They're not there in the lattice action itself. So we're presently, now that we see that it works in perturbation theory, we're looking at non-perturbatively. And for this system, the two-dimensional system, we know what the critical exponent should be, because people are pretty confident that they know what the superconformal field theory is that describes the physics at the fixed point. And so we know what the dimensions are of the relevant operators, and we're trying to extract those from a Monte Carlo for comparison, just to see that at a non-perturbative level, this works as well. So let me just finish up with a quick review of the Monte Carlo simulation we did. It's very simple, just extract Green's functions. I don't probably have to explain any of this to you. Extract the leading masses as a function of time. Usual thing. I should say something about this down here. We set the size of the system to 1. So what that means is that we choose our mass, our inverse mass, to be much, much less than 1. And then the lattice spacing is related to the number of sites by an inverse. So we choose M 10 here, so the Compton wavelength is about 1/10, and so it fits well within the lattice. So here is a plot. These are unfortunately somewhat noisy. So if you don't introduce a subtraction at all for the bosons, you get this mass down here, it's way off from the continuum value. We have, okay, so lattice spacing is going this way. This is zero lattice spacing. So you can see that here is without a counterterm. It just is doesn't seem to be going to where it should be. Down here, we should be well toward the continuum limit. And if you introduce the counterterm, just the leading counterterm, it seems like it's going the right direction. And if you order A, improve it, it definitely looks like it's going to the right continuum limit.
In this other case, the dependence should be order A squared?
It should be. So, okay, and these are the fermion masses. And they all seem to be kind of going up to the continuum. We're still having some problems here getting errors down. But they do seem to be heading up to the continuum in all cases for the fermions. Here's some better data that we did at strong coupling, or at order one coupling. We took a lot more samples here because we don't have perturbation theory to rely on. And you can see that, okay, so here's the supersymmetric lattice action with Catterell and Gregory's data. And that looks like it's working out just fine. And then here's our order A improved boson masses and fermion masses. So those look pretty good. And then to answer your question, here's it in the very end of that plot versus 1 over n. And you can see that the supersymmetric lattice action seems to be falling on a straight line. So that looks like it's got order A errors. This doesn't look like it's falling so much on a straight line here. For the fermions, that could be order A squared. This one I'm a little bit concerned about, but maybe I'd like to get more points here, actually. Here's it plotted versus 1 over n squared. So definitely this supersymmetric lattice action doesn't look like it's got order A squared errors. This one looks like it could be order A squared. The order A improved action could be order A squared. And this one I'm not real happy with. I'd like to get more data out here. And that's actually it. Yeah.
So suppose you could, you were very successful and you managed to put supersymmetric gauge theory on the lattice and everything. What kind of questions would you like to address?
Well, there's a couple questions. I think people have little doubt that gauge-Unno condensation occurs, but people would also like to understand any kind of good description of it in terms of, what are the degrees of freedom of it? Is there some kind of semi-classical understanding? There's suggestions that maybe fractionally, configurations with fractional topological charge could be important. So one might want to study that question. Another question is that there's some two-dimensional super-Yang-Mills theories where it's not well understood what happens when the scalar fields are small. When you write down the effective action, it blows up at this point. But people really don't know what states might be coming in to invalidate it. So that might be something that could be studied, and that's actually relevant to some issues that come up in string theory. So yeah, I think that's the two things just kind of off the top of my head. It might be nice to be able to do gauged supersymmetric quantum mechanics, since that's supposed to describe, give you a non-perturbative description of a particular string theory in a particular background. Other than that, I don't know.
done so early, easily anybody has comments they want to make on thoughts towards paper, maybe it's just too hard a problem for anybody to say.
A very naive question. If your theory is supersymmetric, then the beta function vanishes.
No. Mm-hmm. Only if it's super conformal. Yeah, I mean, like n equals 4, that's true. Four dimensional n equals 4. But for a lot of the theories you study, no, it does have running.
So there's no difficulty taking the continuum limit?
You mean finding the UV fixed point? Just, not that I know of. I mean, you may still have the issues. Have you studied all the fixed points? There might be some other interesting theory. I mean, that's kind of one thing you might want to do is ask, is there some other interesting fixed point to define a continuum limit about? Other than just, you know, the usual, you know, coupling limit. In fact, in these two-dimensional Wessamino models, there's, you know, there is a critical line that you kind of have to follow. That's what I'm doing right now.
So let me answer a little bit off the question. I mean, you were doing this with quantum mechanics with a non-compact variable x.
Yeah.
If you have a compact variable, like we usually do with lattice gates theory, then I was under the impression that supersymmetry tended to want to be spontaneously broken. Is that right, or
what? It depends on the theory. This particular superpotential I wrote down, we know that it's not spontaneously broken.
But if I did a, suppose I did a compact variable, does that still true?
What you typically do is you compute the Witten index. And if it's zero, then it's possible there could be supersymmetry breaking. As far as specific cases, I don't know off the top of my head. We are working on some CPN models, but I don't know. I don't actually know the answer to your question.
Is anyone here with this superpotential has to be periodic, or is it periodic? Okay.
Anybody
else have any feeling on that question?
Maybe I can ask for a repeat because it's very
fast. Mm-hmm.
It seems that you, I didn't understand what the two forces. One was that you had, say, a continuing theory you want to discretize it, and then you said that there's a new divergence which has to be taken care of by an additional function from which wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But the other was to say, well, I discretize one part of the action, and there's, I want it to be supersymmetric to a certain order. Then there's another term which I should have included that would guarantee that the word identities would be satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
Those are equivalent?
Yeah.
They're identical?
Yeah, yeah. If you fix the counter term using the word identities, that you get the same result. Mostly because it's a super normalizable theory, so once you do it one loop, you're kind of in the game.
In part of answering your question, I'm not sure I understand this, but Molde-Seemann mentioned to me that if you could do the system supersymmetric quantum mechanics, then you could start answering questions about black holes or numerical simulation.
It's certainly true that they have to be very close to zero temperature to do anything in the ADS-CFT correspondence, and they don't really know how to move away from that in a reliable way.
So you might consider that as a path to doing the contract.
Yeah. Okay.
You didn't really get it. That's too hard here because the problem is too hard.
The problem doesn't appear too hard because what if like the right approach for it? You took the model, you had the discretization that was required in order to move doubles, then you identified the right discretization in order to make the supersymmetric theory to sort of an order.
Yeah.
Why doesn't that just work all the time?
No, this is So certainly in the quantum mechanics thing that where it's super normalizable, then at least in perturbation theory, it's very straightforward. And there's other theories where this is true also, where it's super normalized. The lattice perturbation series is super normalizable. But to prove it non-perturbatively then becomes difficult in a field theory context. It's much more difficult to do, say, a transfer matrix analysis on a field theory than it is for quantum mechanics. And you know, you can check the word identities with the Monte Carlo simulation at order, but how many of them do you check before you're convinced that you've got it non-perturbatively right? So that's, and then you get to other theories where it's not, the lattice perturbation theory is not super normalizable. Even if the continuum is super normalizable, the lattice perturbation series might not be. You have to check that. Gauge theories, it's a little more work. And if it's not, then it really becomes difficult to adjust the counterterms without fine tuning, especially if you're interested in anything that you can't describe with perturbation theory. Which is,
why do you say this one term's not fine tuned? I mean, it has to be exactly the same as the fermion term.
Because I don't have to work at it. I do the one loop calculation, and I know exactly what the answer is. So my definition of fine tuning is that I don't have to work. I would have to really work at it. I'd have to look and look at for each point in the coupling. You know, I'd have to figure out what exactly I do for each lattice spacing. I have to, you know, do a non-perturbative normalization of the theory. That would be very difficult and time-consuming. That's the kind of fine-tuning I think people want to avoid.